good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Mopod Podcast. I don't know how many of you are in the immediate area, but holy god damn, it's cold this morning. Jesus cripes. I actually had to go inside the house, get the grill lighter, and light my key almost on fire to get it to turn inside my lock. That's how sharp a temperature change we had. Plus, yesterday it was cold and wet and rain. It was supposed to snow. We didn't get any snow here, but they got some snow near us. And I'm torn on the matter. On the upside, that means that my lawn boy season is just about done. However, on the other hand, I mean, snow is coming. And dear God, I hate snow. But so be it. Oh, broadcasting for me Thursday again at work. Yesterday got a little bit too hectic because, I reneged on something that I said that I was not going to do last week. Last week's podcast, for those of you who follow studiously, I said that I was not going to participate in the NaNoWriMo. And for those of you that don't know, the NaNoWriMo is the national, November is the National Novel Writing Month. And every year, the NaNoWriMo.org website has a bit of a competition. You have 30 days to write a 50,000 word or more novel. And I wasn't going to do it. I thought I've got too much on my mind. I'm trying to rewrite the first book. My book, which I titled The Darkling Plain, which first introduced the characters of Mac and Alex and Mike and Trey, who I've been reading about here on the podcast. And then I had a great chat with my buddy Nate the other night, got some good notes on my sci-fi noir book, for which I still have no title. He gave me some good input on what I need to do to get that publication ready. I thought, that's it. I've got too much going on. I'm rehearsing for the play. I'm playing in a band. And I'm maybe going to play in another band. It's just too much. Well, then Tuesday came. November 1st, the kickoff for NaNoWriMo. And I was sitting around all day doing stuff for work. And my mind started working and spinning. And that was just not a good thing at all, because then all of a sudden I felt the compulsion to write, which was good, because the compulsion to write has been fleeting for me recently as of late, so I was very excited about that. And so I rushed home at 4 o'clock, and basically until I had to leave the computer, I was writing. And then yesterday, since it was all cold and wet and rainy, I brought my laptop to work and I was clacking on the keys, which is also rare for me, because for the last couple years I have not been able to write well just punching directly into the computer. I have to write it out longhand. But not the last 2 days. I busted out over 5,000 words since 4 o'clock Tuesday. And for me, that's a pretty prolific amount of output. And I'm pretty happy with that. I've got a character which I think is fun. A character that my buddy Mark has kind of wanted me to write for a while. And I think it's because this character reminds him of me, basically. And I've had some characters that I've wanted to put into a story. And I've had one little fledgling whisper of an idea about a character pairing. And I thought, why not? So, yeah, I don't know where I'm going to go with it. I have a rough idea, but we'll see what happens. Sometimes my best work happens if I'm just mindlessly clacking at the computer without an outline, just kind of see where it goes. And hopefully I don't lose track of it and get bored with it, which I have been known to do, especially with a NaNoWriMo project in the past. Oh, yeah. What else is going on? Survived the birthday weekend. just. My birthday falls right before Halloween. So as a result, I sometimes have to forsake my birthday and a little bit of birthday revelry in order to be the quote-unquote rock star bartender. Of course, for those of you that don't know, Halloween is one of the drinkingest nights of the year. I'd put it right up there with New Year's Eve. And it's also amateur hour. You get people that don't necessarily go out that often, don't know how to behave themselves in a bar, don't know how to drink and not fall down, and it just gets stupid. And the bar I'm currently at is currently outside of the city limits of where I presently live. It's in another community, which allows, and this community drinks until 2 o'clock. Bars in my town, where I actually live, can only drink till 1. So the bar I work at now, everybody makes a mad dash around 12:30, 1 o'clock to go squeeze in another hour of drinking after they've already been getting a little bit pissed up and forget how to behave like quote-unquote civilized adults. I was running, I was gunning, I was slinging booze like a madman, and I had to yell at people a lot. So why I had to yell? Well, I'm going to take a few minutes out of a literary-based podcast and turn this into Moe's Bar Podcast Corner. Let's talk about basic bar etiquette, shall we?
Yes, let's. Now, against common belief, it is a common misconception that if you slam your fist or a beer bottle or an ashtray on the bar top, you are going to get served faster. Oh no, my friend. It is also very impolite when the bartender is in the middle of a huge order. When you see him pouring 5 different drinks, mixing some shots, grabbing beers out of the cooler, to start yelling out your 5 or 6-piece drink order. He's not listening to you. He doesn't care. He's not ready yet. Wait your goddamn turn. Also, when he's in the cash register, sticking your fist full of money in his face to let him know that you're ready, or snapping your fingers an inch or two away from his nose, not a good idea. I personally snapped at and grabbed several wrists and told people to go shove their money where it's not supposed to be. Also, now this is actually a true story that happened a couple weeks ago. The person has since come up and apologized, which was wonderful. But he gave me a ridiculously large tip to burn his drink, for which I was grateful. However, this gentleman later decided that since he had given me this exorbitant tip, that this put him to the front of the line no matter how many people were waiting ahead of him for when he came up for his next drink. The long story short is, when he voiced his displeasure, I took his exorbitant tip, threw it back at him, and told him to go fuck himself. As I said, he did apologize. And I was gracious. He'd been drinking. He kind of lost his mind, if you will, for a moment. Now, here's the other thing. Never, ever, 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 ask the bartender the following question. Don't you know who I am? Friday night, I had a gentleman come up to the bar, and he ordered a Jack and Coke. I said, sure. Started pouring for him, and he said, hey, throw some more Jack in there. Burn it. I said, fine. Do you want a double? He says, yeah, give me a double. I said, that's fine. Just keep in mind that if I pour you a double, I am going to charge you double. What? Hey, that's what it is. You want 2 shots? You're going to get charged for 2 shots. Do you want the double? He says, yes, give me the double. I said, fine. Fill up the glass. There's a little bit of room left between the top of the glass and the beverage. He says, hey, yo, fill up the rest of that little bit with Jack. Well, now you want a triple shot. What? That's a triple shot. You want me to charge you triple? It's now going to be $10, $12. He says, what? I said, yeah, that's what it is, man. If you want a triple shot, you have to pay triple. He says, don't you know who I am? No. No, seriously, you don't know who I am? No. Who the fuck are you? He stood and stared at me dumbfounded until I finally said, do you want the triple? He said, no, no, just give me the damn double. I said, fine. I later threw him out of the bar for molesting women. They didn't know who he was either, and they cared less than I did. I would again real briefly like to share an incredibly true story with you. Last Friday, my afternoon was going along very slowly. It was rubbish, actually. And then all of a sudden on the iPod shuffle came this particular song. A song called Killer Ray by Mr. Kyle Ashe, performed by Mr. Kyle Ashe and his organ trio. And I have to tell you, I then went straight to my iPod, turned off the shuffle, and called up the full Kyle Ashe catalog on my iPod. Granted, it's only two albums at present, but god damn, they're good. And they totally changed my worldview for the afternoon and made me a much happier man. And I really believe they can do the same for you. So, please, go to Amazon.com, support a guy that's helping to support me and my podcast. Look up Kyle Ashe, Organ Trio. You can find two albums. One is called The Best For You, or The Best Thing For You, or no, excuse me, God. One is called The Hookup. That would be the first album. The second one is the Kyle Ashe Organ Trio featuring Mel Ryan, and that is called Blues for Mel. Please check them both out. And while you're there, do like a half dozen other people have done, and buy one of my works. Again, I have two books, full-length books available there, and two short stories available for the Kindle program, which you can either go out and get yourself a nice Kindle, which I'm still on the fence about, or you can download the Kindle program to your laptop, your Mac, your Apple device, or your mobile Android device, your BlackBerry. I have to tell you, having a Kindle on my phone is pretty handy. It really, truly is. Just because of you find yourself in a situation, you get a little bit bored. You don't want to be that guy that's on Facebook all day long, which I am. So you go and you can call up a book. Expand your mind, as it were. I'm not being so bold as to suggest that my books will change your worldview, but just buy my books, please. Is that too much to ask? Gosh, I would just be so appreciative. And, of course, one of those books that you can find is called Our Own Devils, which I've been reading here for the last couple months. We are currently up to chapter 23, page 195 of 272 in the full-length manuscript, which is only available on my laptop. So if you're trying to figure out where you are as far as page numbers on the Kindle, I can't help you. But I know where I'm at. And as I said, this is chapter 23. We have the uneasy alliance between Mac and Deshaun, the former and the current lovers of Ms. Alex Pine, trying to figure out what to do. They've got a mysterious assailant with a mullet to track down. What's going to happen? Let's find out now. Fortunately, I did have at least one idea about what to do. Mike had gotten back to me that morning before I left town with the pedigree of the license plate number I'd given him from the night before. While I hadn't got a name or an address of the man who'd attacked me, I did at least get a place to start. The Pontiac had been reported stolen from a used car lot near 27th and Superior. It wasn't a home run, but it was something at least. I parked my Ford Tempo in a convenience store parking lot across the street from Crazy Cat's Used Car Emporium and stared at the car lot. The perimeter of the emporium was surrounded by a rope of plastic or vinyl flags of varying colors strung from light poles. All of the windshields had neon green sticker decals advertising ridiculous savings. From the look of things, the Pontiac had been the finest automobile on the damn lot. The newest car at the place had to have been at least 3 years old, but had enough rust pockets peppered around it for a car 10 years older. I couldn't scoff. I'd probably be there within a year to buy a car. "So, how are we going to play this?" said Deshaun from the passenger seat of my car. I looked at him from the corner of my eye. "We? What the hell do you mean, we?" "I told you, I get to go with you." "And you are with me. It doesn't mean you're going to be my partner or anything. Are you expecting me to put you through Connolly's School of Investigation or something?" "I don't know, man, but I sure as fuck ain't sitting in the goddamn car the whole time." "Fine. You don't have to wait in the car, but don't be following me like a goddamn lab dog either. Just hang out off to the side and act like you're looking at cars, okay?" "Whatever, man," Deshaun said, the frustration obvious in his voice. I got out of the car and started walking across the street, careful to pull my shirt out enough so that it hid the Glock stuffed into the back of my jeans. It felt uncomfortable as hell to have the gun against my bare skin, but I didn't want anyone on the lot to be freaked out by it. I walked around the lot casually, glancing at the sticker prices on the windshields and the stat sheets taped to the inside of the windows. I was just another poor schmuck dumb enough to think about buying a car from this dump. It wasn't until I settled in tight against a beat-up old 1987 Cutlass that someone finally appeared from inside the small shed that served as the office. He was an older guy with a pot belly that stuck out in front of him as he walked. He seemed to have to lean backward slightly as he walked to counter the dead weight in front of him. He was shorter than I was, with long, slicked back hair that had been turned almost completely gray. The closer he got to me, the less I thought his hair was slicked back, and the more I thought it was just greasy from having gone unwashed for several days.
"It never fails. People still love the old Cutlasses."
I laughed and nodded in agreement.
"It still surprised me how many young high school boys come in here looking for them. You'd think they'd all be getting from them zippy little foreign cars, waiting to be all fast and furious like that movie with their rides all pimped out and what have you." "I'm Timmy Birch. This is my car lot. So, what brings you over to this fine piece of American engineering?"
"Oh, there's just something about him," I said with a shrug and an almost embarrassed smile. I looked around the lot quickly and saw Deshaun checking out a 1992 Geo hatchback as he glanced over at me repeatedly.
"Don't be embarrassed, son. That's part of the fun of going out shopping for a car. You never know what's going to catch your eye. Last car I bought, I was looking for a brand new truck. I was all fired up about getting me a big old 4x4 with a Hemi in it. You know what I bought? A goddamn VW Bug. You believe that shit? But what can I tell you? The damn little German fucker caught my eye and I drove it off the lot that very day. So now, tell me, does this Cutlass have the same effect on you?"
I hunched up my shoulders and rocked from side to side on the balls of my feet, the very picture of indecision.
"You know, I always have wanted one. But this actually isn't my first choice. I drove by here the other day and saw one that I really liked, but I don't see it around. Someone probably bought it already."
"Hold on there, son."
He reached out and patted me on the shoulder. It was probably a very comforting tool when he was clean.
"Don't give up hope yet. Maybe it's just out on a test drive."
I doubted anyone had taken a car out for a test drive in years.
"Now, which one were you interested in?"
"There was this silver Pontiac here a few days ago. I think it was like a Grand Am or something. Do you know which one I'm talking about?" The glimmer of self-assurance left the dealer's eyes, and the upturned corners of his mouth fell a little.
"Pontiac," he said slowly, probably trying to pull his thoughts together. "That's the one that caught your eye, huh? I'm sorry, son, but that car's currently off the lot."
I wasn't sure if he was put off because he was possibly missing out on a sale or because someone was asking about that car.
"Oh, yeah? Someone got it out for a test drive?" Something like that.
one of those night drives. You know, I thought I saw that car out the other day. Some guy with, like, this mullet was driving it, right? I couldn't pinpoint exactly what it was, but something about Timmy seemed to give away that he knew about my friend with the mullet. I wasn't sure if it was something in his eyes or the way he held his shoulders, but something about his demeanor told me he knew.
Yeah, something like that. Now, why don't we take a nice long look at this Cutlass? It's got a T-top roof.
Yeah, that's great and all, but I've really got a thing for that Pontiac. When do you think it might be back on the lot?
Let's not worry about that old Pontiac right now. Not when we've got a great classic like this Cutlass right here. Why don't we go ahead and take this little baby out for a spin?
We could, but I really think I'd like to wait and try that Pontiac out. You know, it's like you said, that's the one that caught my eye. When will it be back?
Timmy's cocksure attitude broke down a little more. He started to rock slightly from side to side and ran one sausage-fingered hand through his greasy mop of hair. He looked around almost desperately, searching for someone to come help him or maybe just another customer who wasn't so stubborn about one particular car. He saw Deshaun still hovering over the Geo, and his face lit up again as he started quickly toward him, his body language full of the bravado I'd just sapped from him.
"Hey there," he said happily with a wave. "That's not a bad car there. It's made out of a lot of recycled materials. Did you know that?"
No, I didn't know that," Deshaun replied with a polite nod. "I'm really just kind of looking around a bit. You go ahead fishing helping that other guy."
He'll be all right. I don't think he really knows what he wants. But you, on the other hand, appear to be a young man who knows exactly what he wants. Am I right?"
"Nah, not just yet, man. I'm just walking around kind of weighing my options out. You know what I'm saying?"
"Yo, sure thing, my man,"
Timmy said, a little twinkle of self-assuredness back in his eye.
"I feel you, G. You just take your time and holler when you need me, dog."
Oh, Timmy, you are so very white, I thought to myself. He backed away from Deshaun, smiling and nodding. He turned around carefully, probably hoping that I wouldn't be there when he came around. I was, but not by the Cutlass. I walked over to him while he was talking to Deshaun, and so that when he turned around, his pronounced belly bumped into me. He jumped back slightly and took in a sharp breath of air.
"Hi! What's the word on that Pontiac?"
Timmy's shoulders fell, and he looked around the lot quickly, making sure that Deshaun was the only other person on the lot. Satisfied, he took me by the arm and led me away where he couldn't be heard.
"All right, kid." "Kid? I'll level with you. The car's not here, and it probably won't be back for a while, okay?"
"Why? What happened?"
"It was stolen, all right? I didn't want to say anything because it's kind of embarrassing. I mean, I got all this security around, the cameras up on the light poles, and a security guy drives through the lot a few times a night."
I looked around, and the cameras were indeed there. I hadn't even noticed them stuck between the halogen bulbs.
"This kind of thing happens. You really don't want it to get out, or people might start picking on your lot, you know?"
"Sure. Gosh, that's too bad."
"Yeah, it really is."
He made yet another attempt to suck it up.
"But, how about that Cutlass? That's still here."
I looked over at it and did more of my nervous shuffling. I don't know. I'll think about it. The last bit of swagger he had in him slowly fell away as I walked away and waved politely. He looked back over at Deshaun, probably hoping to salvage something from his day, but he was walking away as well. I was thankful that Deshaun was taking a very long way around to get back to my car. Maybe he wasn't quite so dumb. It took Deshaun about 5 minutes to take his end-around trip back to my car. While waiting for him, I observed Timmy rustling around inside the small shack he called an office. He picked up a white cordless phone and called someone, pacing back and forth in the small room until someone answered. I wondered what he did if he had to go to the little car dealer's room.
"What's up?" said Deshaun once he got inside of the car. "How'd I do?"
"Not bad," it was almost painful to admit.
"So, what now?"
"We wait."
"For what?"
"For him. He's been on the phone for a little while now. He called someone almost as soon as we left. My guess is he'll be leaving here shortly."
"To go where?"
I took a deep breath and let it out slowly. If I knew Tashawn, it wouldn't be a big mystery, and I'd just go there myself, wouldn't I? Tashawn rolled his eyes and shook his head. Sure enough, within a few minutes, Timmy's phone conversation was done, and he was locking up his meager shop. He was walking away so quickly, his obese frame was practically waddling as he ran towards the cutlass I'd been eyeing, a pair of magnetic dealer's license plates in his hands. He slapped one to each end of the car and drove off. We followed. Following people had never been my strong suit. The whole art and technique of staying behind someone, but not too far behind them, and making sure that you weren't spotted or didn't lose your target wasn't all that easy for me. But sometimes there are details that make it easier to do. The first detail is the target being oblivious. It's easier to follow someone when they don't know that they're being followed. They're not suddenly turning or changing lanes to check for someone behind them. The second detail is simplicity. We pulled in behind Timmy Birch and the Oldsmobile Cutlass on 27th Street and followed him south. And that was pretty much it. I tried to stay several car lengths behind him, which wasn't too hard because there wasn't quite a bit of traffic. But this also sometimes made it hard to stay with him because people would slow down and whatnot. For traveling straight most of the way, it was a royal pain in the ass. Plus, Tashawn didn't want to shut up all that much. So what'd you find out from Fat Boy? Not much, other than the fact that I'm pretty sure that he knows the guy that tried to take me out. How'd you know? He tell you? Not exactly, but something about the way he acted told me he knows something about him, and the way he kind of panicked when I wouldn't stop bugging him about the Pontiac. He probably doesn't know much, but I'm willing to bet that he knows something. So why are we following him? You got anything better to do? Tashawn shrugged. Yeah, me neither. Timmy Birch led us into a very well-to-do neighborhood near the country club of Lincoln and the private golf course it kept tucked away in the middle of the southern part of the city. We traveled south on 27th to Van Dorn, where we turned west for a short while before turning south on 24th Street, where the medians lined with trees separate the north and south lanes. He made a U-turn where 24th Street and Cedar met near the northeast corner of the golf course and parked in front of the large house on that corner. I kept driving south for a few blocks before making a U-turn myself between two medians in a spot where, judging by the glare of a 60-ish woman walking her toy poodle gave me, was not a proper place to make a U-turn. You don't suppose that's a dude's house, do you? I doubt that dude even gets invited to cocktail parties at houses like that, I said as I slowed down to drive past the house. Timmy was already inside, so I wasn't too worried about being seen driving past. The house was a large, dark brick number with two floors above ground as well as probably a basement. As we drove past, I could just make out part of a diving board perched above an in-ground swimming pool. The place probably had 6 bedrooms, 8 bathrooms, and a back patio large enough to entertain every last member of the country club of Lincoln. An engraved stone in the front landscaping read Applegate in block script next to a painted stone sculpture of Herbie Husker. That thing say what I think it said, said Tashawn once we'd driven completely past. Yep. What does that mean? I don't know, but we'll sure as hell have to find out. Does this new information help us out at all? Tashawn said as we drove back up 27th Street. He'd been bugging me with questions ever since we had left Russell Applegate's house. It wasn't like we were at the bottom of the hour in the episode of some TV detective show where learning one small connection wrapped everything up in time for the evening news. Well, it tells me that the guy who made a run at me and this lawyer are probably connected. I guarantee you that if I were to break into that little shack of an office at the car lot and ransack the security tapes he's supposed to have there, we'd see that car dealer handing that asshole the keys to that Pontiac. Now, what exactly that connection is beyond that, I don't know. So, how do you find that out? You can't exactly walk up to that lawyer dude and ask him. No, he'd have my ass thrown in jail in no time. So, I need to work on his connection to the whole thing from another angle. How do you do that? By possibly buying a chastity belt, I thought. Not too long afterward, Tashawn and I were sitting in front of Stephen and Mary Sinovec's house. The house looked about the same as it had the last time I'd been there.
I was working on the assumption that Mary Sinovec would be home just as she had been the last time. I didn't think that her work schedule would change all that much in a week's time. At risk to my virtue, I was going in alone again. Deshaun had wanted to go in with me as my unofficial partner, but Mary had a pretty good idea of who he was, and she'd also more than demonstrated to me her feelings on racial equality. All in all, it was going to be more beneficial for him to stay in the car. I took a deep breath and pressed the doorbell. Once again, the ring of the bell caused a sharp yapping inside of the house, followed by a small thud against the front door. There seemed to be a definite pattern of behavior with Gilby, the Sinovec's dog. Mary Sinovec wasn't too far behind Gilby. This time, at least, I hadn't interrupted her daily workout. Today, she was dressed probably for work, in a pair of functional yet flattering blue jeans and a tight t-shirt for a rock band I'd never heard of. No big surprise there, though. I wasn't very hip.
"Hi there, Chuck, isn't it?" said Mary Sinovec with a warm smile.
She cocked her torso to the side and tossed her hair in such a way that I could tell that it was some sort of sexual overture. I'd had a lot of practice keeping a watchful eye for such things. "Yeah," I said without sounding hoarse. "I'm trying to track down a couple more friends of Alex's. Do you think I could come in for a little bit?"
"Absolutely," she said, smiling at me with her eyes in a way that made me blush a little.
Even in plain clothes, she radiated sexual energy.
"I don't have a lot of time, though, I'm afraid," she said once we were inside the living room at the top of the stairs.
Gilby, the Yorkshire Terrier, was running circles around my feet and wagging his tail at supersonic speed.
"I have to work this afternoon, and I've got a few errands I need to run beforehand, but I would love to help you."
The emphasis she put on the word love was laced with sexual innuendo. She gestured for me to sit on the couch, which I did. The couch was so soft and thick that I was afraid I wouldn't be able to get up out of it if Mary tried to sexually accost me. She sat down next to me sideways so that she was facing me, with her long legs coiled up underneath her and one shoulder on the back of the couch so that she could rest her head on her hand. She looked at me attentively and batted her eyes at me all at the same time. She was so close that her legs and arms were touching. I could feel sweat beginning to bead on my forehead. "That's fine," I said. "Hopefully this won't take too long." I closed my eyes and mentally slapped myself, remembering why I was there. I quickly repeated the question a few times in my head before opening my mouth. Suddenly, I wasn't feeling flushed or sexually frustrated anymore. I was once more a man with a purpose.
"Mary, did you know or ever hear Alex mention a man named Russell Applegate?"
Suddenly, nearly all of Mary Sinovec's sexual intensity was gone. Her eyes widened, and the coy little smile she had fell for a moment. She recovered quickly, so quickly, in fact, that at first I wasn't sure that I'd seen it happen. She knew him, all right.
"No, I don't think so."
She was a damn good liar. Her voice didn't falter one bit.
"Who is he?"
"A lawyer. He would have come by asking about her and what she was doing a couple of months ago." She shook her head, probably more than she needed to.
"Nope, no lawyer ever came by here looking for Alex. Could you excuse me for a minute? I need to go to the little girl's room."
I nodded with a smile. After all, it was her house. How could I tell her no? She scurried off quickly down the hall with Gilby following close behind. Hard down. It took a moment, but I was eventually able to climb up and out of the couch and do a little snooping. The main living room upstairs was rather Spartan. The only photograph of the room was a professional shot of Mary done with a soft light filter. The picture was a stylized job with her done up to look like Lauren Bacall from one of her early movies with Humphrey Bogart. I found it narcissistic that hers was the only picture in the room. She could have at least put up a picture of her and her husband together. From the living room, I wandered into the kitchen. What the living room lacked in personal decor, the kitchen refrigerator made up for in spades. The bulk of the fridge door, from about waist up, was completely covered with photographs. Mary was featured in most of them. Snapshots of her on Main Street, USA, in front of the fairy tale castle at Disneyland, under the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, and also a sexual gesture to a uniformed guard outside of Buckingham Palace. For a couple of factory workers, they sure seemed to do quite a bit of traveling. Maybe I needed to switch professions.
I was just about ready to walk out of the kitchen when one more picture on the side of the fridge caught my eye. It was another picture of Mary in Paris, but this was one of the few where she wasn't alone in the shot. She was standing with the Eiffel Tower in the background at night, with the tower lined with lights. A man who was probably about 6'3" and looked like he was big into weightlifting was holding Mary tightly. He also had a bit of a mullet. My heart rate spiked and my breathing stopped for just a moment. I yanked the picture off of the fridge, knocking a couple of magnets down, and stuffed the picture into my back pocket. I crouched down to pick up the magnets and stopped short again. One of the magnets on the floor was a business card-sized one with a simple white backing. The top of the magnet read in flowing maroon script, Lincoln Repertory Theater. It featured the theater's phone number and email address for reservations, and below that was a list of the theater's production schedule from a few years earlier. I put it in my pocket and put the other magnet back on the fridge and turned to leave. Mounted to the wall that separated the kitchen from the living room was the base for a cordless phone. The handset was gone and the in-use light was on. I took my picture and magnet and ran out the front door. Well, there you go, kids. Chapter 23 of Our Own Devils. Things are starting to spice up a little bit. What's going to happen next? Well, there's only two ways to find out. One, you can be cheap, which is okay, and tune in next week, download the podcast, or listen to it live, stream it from your Facebook page, your Tumblr, your Podomatic web page, or you can download it onto your iPod or other MP3 playing device, or you could go to Amazon.com and for a scant $5, purchase and download, and within 60 seconds you can read Our Own Devils in full. Granted, you will not have the relaxing, soothing timbre of my voice to read it to you, but some days we just have to make do with what we can. And also, please, if you like what is going on here, go to Facebook and like the podcast on Mopod Podcast. There you can also keep up to date with this damn NaNoWriMo project that I decided to take on. And you can also stay up to date with whatever else might be cooking. Also, you can drop me an email at mopod@live.com. Give me suggestions, feedback, what have you. Alright, I gotta get out of here. Stupid NaNoWriMo. Good God, I got a lot.